Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to the Torah portion for April 26th and 27th from sundown to sundown. This teaching is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com. themessianicmessage.com. I hope that you enjoyed this teaching. This week's Torah portion is called Emor. It means say, and it is from Leviticus chapter 21, verse 1 to Leviticus 24:23. The Haftarah is Ezekiel 44, verses 15 to 31, and the Brit Hadashah is 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 4 through 10. And with that, before we get started, let's say a word of prayer. We thank you, Heavenly Father, for your word and for your Sabbaths where we can study your word all day long and be in your presence. And we just thank you for bringing us to the end of the age when we know that you are going to send Yeshua back to rule for you on the earth, Abba. I thank you for your people, and I pray that you will protect us and provide for us all around the world, wherever we are. I pray for the peace of Jerusalem and for the protection of the Jewish people in the land, protection from their enemies. And Abba, I just pray that whoever is hearing this message that you have given me, that, you know, your words would speak to them and my words would just die before they even hit the people's ears. I pray that only your words would go forth, Abba. And I pray all this in the name of Yeshua. Amen. Emor means say, or some say it means speak. At the beginning of this Torah portion, it says that the Lord spoke to Moses and said, this is what you're going to tell the children of Israel. Let's go to Leviticus chapter 21, verse 1, where it says, and the Lord said to Moses, speak to the priests, the son of Aaron. That word there, said, the Lord said, is emor. And that word, speak, is also emor. It's the same word. So it is the Lord speaking to Moses, and then Moses will be speaking to the priests. And the things that the Lord is speaking about in this Torah portion have to do with particular kinds of distinctions. What kind of distinctions am I talking about? Well, first, the distinctions of Yehovah. Now, what kind of distinctions might there be? None, because there is no distinction between the Father and Yeshua. They are one. But then we have the distinctions of different levels of government, distinctions of people in the government of the nation of Israel, and that is the high priest, the priests, and the individual Hebrews, and then, of course, strangers that live among them, being also Gentiles in some instances, and in other instances, strangers being those who have decided to live permanently and be like Ruth, who said, may your people be my people, and your God be my God. And then there is the distinctions of time, and there's another important distinction in this Torah portion. And I believe that it's in here to show the distinction between Jehovah's ways and the world's ways. And that is the distinction of mercy. Now we're going to go through these distinctions, and I'm going to jump around a little bit. So I hope that you've already read the Torah portion, because I'm not going to read it in order today. I want to explain what these messages are instead. The distinctions of Yehovah. And as I said, there is no distinction between the Father and Yeshua. You know, when he's talking here in Emor, he makes a distinction between the high priest and the priests, you know, that group of people together, as distinct from his instructions for the people, the laity, as I'll call it. But when it comes to the Father and Yeshua, there is no distinction between them, because Yeshua said in John chapter 10, verse 30, I and my Father are one. So in that distinction, we have that there is Father and Son, and they are one, and they, Yehovah, together, are distinct from the people. Yehovah is making distinctions between himself and human beings by regulating the way that we may approach him. And these regulations pertain to everyone, not just to those who are native-born in Israel, as we shall see. All of chapter 22 speaks of this distinction. It speaks about the distinction between Jehovah and his people. Now, I'm just going to skip down to Leviticus 22, verse 18. And by the way, I am reading from the scriptures this week. They seem to make this a lot clearer. Speak to Aharon and his sons and to all the children of Israel and say to them, any man of the house of Israel or of the strangers in Israel who brings his offering for any of his vow, for any of his voluntary offerings, which they shall bring to Jehovah as a burnt offering for your acceptance, is a male, a perfect one from the cattle, from the sheep, or from the goats. Now, that word stranger there in verse 18 is ger. It means a guest. It does not mean goy, as in Gentile or pagan. And now down to verse 20. Whatever has a defect, you do not bring, for it is not acceptable for you. And when a man brings a peace offering to Jehovah to complete a vow or a voluntary offering from the cattle or the sheep, it is to be perfect, to be accepted. Let there be no defect in it. Those blind or broken or having a cut or having an ulcer or eczema or scabs, you do not bring to Jehovah, nor make an offering by fire of them on the altar to Jehovah. As for a bull or lamb that has any limb deformed or dwarfed, you do not prepare as a voluntary offering. But for a vow, it is not accepted. Do not bring to Jehovah what is bruised or crushed or torn or cut, nor do it in your land. And from a son of a stranger's hand, you do not bring any of these as the bread of your Elohim. For their corruption is in them, and defects are in them, and they are not acceptable for you. That word there in verse 25 for stranger is nekar. And one of the meanings of the word nekar is heathen. So there's a distinction between this kind of stranger here in verse 25 and the kind of stranger in verse 18. You see that the Lord will allow guests to come before him, but he will not allow heathens to come before him. They can't come before him in the way that heathens do. You see what I'm saying? Now, if they want to come before him in the way that he specifies, and they have become a guest in the land, in other words, they are willing to abide by Jehovah's rules, then really technically that means they are grafted in and they can come before him. But if not, then they are not able to come before him because their corruption is in them. So what he's saying there is there's a difference between the kind of stranger that comes and is with you and is like you and does what you do. And really, you know, he calls them a guest, but there really is, they are followers of Jehovah as opposed to the stranger that he calls a heathen. Okay, Leviticus 24, verse 16. And he who blasphemes the name of Jehovah shall certainly be put to death, and all the congregation certainly stone him, the stranger as well as the native. When he blasphemes the name, he is put to death. So the man there in chapter 24 that blasphemed the name of Jehovah while he was involved in a fight was stoned, as we know from reading the Torah portion. Now, these distinctions are the distinctions that Jehovah has made between himself and human beings. In these, he has told you, it's kind of a summary of what we've been learning in the previous Torah portions of how to approach him. So the way that he makes the distinction between himself and humans is by regulating how we approach him and how we behave even when we're not approaching him. As in when that man blasphemed the name during a fight. You know, he was in a fight. He wasn't coming before the Lord with an offering. Now, next we have the distinction between the priesthood and the laity, and the priesthood and the Gentiles. Now, we're going to read from chapter 21, starting at verse 1. And Jehovah said to Moshe, speak to the priests, the sons of Aaron, and say to them, no one is to be defiled for the dead among his people, except for his relatives who are nearest to him, for his mother, and for his father, and for his son, and for his daughter, and for his brother, and for his maiden sister who is near to him, who has had no husband. For her he is defiled. A leader does not defile himself among his people to profane himself. They do not make any bald place on their heads, and they do not shave the corner of their beard, and they do not make a cutting in their flesh. They are set apart to their Elohim and do not profane the name of their Elohim, for they bring the offerings of Jehovah made by fire and the bread of their Elohim and shall be set apart. So this right here, this prohibition about defiling yourself for any of the dead among your people is different than it is, it's different for the priests than it is for the people or the laity, you see. And so we have this distinction made between the leadership and the people or the laity. And it's reiterated there in verse 4 where it says, a leader does not defile himself among his people to profane himself. Now, in the ancient Near East, when there was a death, they had particular mourning rituals. And the mourning rituals of some of those cultures surrounding the Israelites have to do with the customs that are listed in there. Now, the Egyptians, where the children of Israel had just come out, the Egyptians actually did the opposite of this. They actually stayed shaved all the time in the Egyptian culture until it was time to mourn, and then they let their hair grow. But the Hebrews were to be neither constantly shaven or to make particular cuttings in their hair as the other pagans around them were doing. Now, I believe this is because the mourning period specified in the Torah is 7 days. Now, of course, we know that when Moses died, the nation mourned for 30 days, but the specified mourning period is 7 days. Thus, if you cut yourself or your hair or your beard, you appear to be in mourning far longer than the 7 days, you see? Because hair cannot grow to its original length in that period of time, in 7 days. And since Jehovah is Elohim of life, to approach him in having the appearance of mourning defiles his name. Why? Why? Because it means then that you are saying that he is not the God of the living alone, but he is the God of the living and the dead. You see what I'm trying to get at? And therefore, he would have to act against you, perhaps in the manner that he did with Nadab and Abihu, for such a thing, because if he were to let a person come before him who appeared like they were mourning death, mourning is actually a death ritual. If he let somebody come before him and let them live, it would mean that he is accepting death, and that it would make him no longer the God of only the living, but the God of the living and the dead. That implication there would be far reaching. That would just, defy everything that he has said about being the God of the living. Now, notice that the wife of the priest is not listed among those for whom he may be defiled. Now, there are other commandments where Jehovah does not list the wife when speaking about such matters, household manners, and other things, notably keeping Shabbat. In the commandment, for instance, about keeping Shabbat, it's a plural you there, and because it supposes that the wife is included. Because the husband and wife are one flesh, therefore there is no need for the Lord to explain this premise, since he assumes that we understand that the husband and the wife are one flesh. And so we see the same thing here in the manner in which the priest is able to defile himself. He may defile himself for her because they are one flesh. And it's not necessary for the Lord to explain that they're one flesh. And as that priest's very own flesh, she is closer to him than anyone, which is really what the rabbis say there. And I do agree with him, the rabbis, when they say in verse 2, except for his relatives who are nearest to him. She is included in that list of relatives who are nearest to him for, obvious reasons. And now we're going to come to the distinctions of the people the distinctions of the children of Israel from the strangers, not the guest strangers, but the heathen strangers, and the goy, the Gentiles, who are around them. Let's go to Leviticus chapter 22, verse 32. It says, "And do not profane my set-apart name, and I shall be set apart among the children of Israel. I am Jehovah who sets you apart, and who brought you out of the land of Mitzrayim to be your Elohim. I am Jehovah." And then in chapter 24, verse 22, it says, "You are to have one right ruling for the stranger and for the native, for I am your Elohim." And again, that word for stranger there in verse 22 is ger. It is the guest that is being used there. And the word for native there is Ezrach. It is the sense of the one that sprung forth from that area. You know, it's the sense of springing up in one's own country. And so we see here that the Lord makes a distinction between his people and all other people on the earth. And then there's another way that the Lord makes distinctions in the Torah portion, Emor, and that is that we're to keep set apart times. Hebrews are set apart from the other nations by keeping Jehovah's set apart times. Let's go to Leviticus chapter 23, verse 2. "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, the appointed times of Jehovah which you are to proclaim as set apart gatherings, my appointed times are these. 6 days work is done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of rest, a set apart gathering. You do no work. It is a Sabbath to Jehovah in all your dwellings. These are the appointed times of Jehovah, set apart gatherings which you are to proclaim at their appointed times." And so I'm not going to read all of the chapter regarding these set-apart times, but I will say that the Sabbath is the first set-apart time of all of Jehovah's set-apart times. And then we have to, there's another important understanding that we have to come to, and it's kind of a paradigm shift about Jehovah's feasts, and it's, I don't know if I can convey this to you. It is that we in the Hebrew Roots community are learning the culture that Jehovah has created, and we're getting instruction in the laws of the Commonwealth of Israel, you know, that these are constitutional laws that govern the kingdom of Israel. We're not learning religious law or religious custom here. We are learning what his kingdom will be like. And the way that his kingdom will be in the future is found within the commandments that he gave us in the past. And of course, the Hebrews in their history did fail to cooperate with Jehovah in actually creating his kingdom the way that he designed it to be. But suffice it to say that he is going to have his kingdom, and he is going to have it his way. But one of the paradigm shifts that we need to make, and I don't know how to explain how to have a paradigm shift made, so it's just, the paradigm shift comes when you get something on a kind of cellular level. You don't understand it just emotionally or mentally, or maybe sometimes you understand it emotionally and mentally, but you get it really deep in your soul. That is a paradigm shift. And there's this difference that we need to make, this distinction that we need to make between Jehovah, who is Elohim, and man-made deities that people call God. Now, one difference between Jehovah and worldly deities or gods are his feasts. And why are his feasts different than all other religious feasts? I'm going to tell you this, and maybe this will cause you to have this paradigm shift. The reason the Lord's feasts are different is because they are decreed by him. Let me repeat that. The reason the Lord's feasts are different is because they are decreed by him. No pagan religion exists that has a God that decreed feasts. And I'm going to prove it to you. Let's look at one of the pharaohs that ruled in Egypt. Her name was Queen Hatshepsut. She decreed a feast to her favorite deity, Amun. Now, her example is just one of many, and as we go through this, I'm going to show you more examples of what I'm talking about, how that decrees to keep feasts to gods or deities is a man-made thing. And Jehovah is the only one who decreed his own feasts. Now, getting back to Egypt. Egypt took over where Babylon left off. And here, at the end of days, of course, we are living in this dual, mixed-up kind of spiritual realm. In our world, there is both Babylon and Egypt to contend with. And so it is important for us to make this distinction between Jehovah's feasts and the other feasts that other religions keep. Now, the mixture of Babylon and Egypt has found its way into Christianity. And of course, Christianity has decreed many holidays, Christmas and Easter being the biggest decreed holidays. Let's go to a little thing that I found here on the internet. I think I probably found it on Wikipedia or someplace like that. It was about the establishment of the Nicene Orthodoxy. On 27 February in the year 380, he, together with Gratian and Valentinian II, published the so-called Edict of Thessalonica in order that all their subjects should profess the faith of the bishops of Rome and Alexandria. You see, right here is why I'm telling you that Christianity has Roman and Egyptian, Babylon, Roman, Babylonian, and Alexandrian Babylonian mixture of practices in it. Because they openly admit right here in this decree that I'm reading you that they should profess the faith of the bishops of Rome and Alexandria. Where is Alexandria? It is in Egypt. The move was mainly a thrust at the various beliefs that had arisen out of Arianism, but smaller dissident sects, such as the Macedonians, were also prohibited. So that's what happens, you know, in Christianity. We know that from the 2nd and 3rd centuries forward, Christianity decreed their religious holidays. We know that back in the ancient Babylonian times, they decreed their holidays. We know that back in Egyptian times, they decreed their holidays. And I'm going to show you in the scripture where we have a king who decrees holidays, okay? But first we're going to move on to Islam. Now, millions of Muslims today believe that it was Muhammad who taught them how to pray and conduct their rituals. And so we have that the practices of Islam, according to Islam, was first given to Abraham and his sons. But in any case, it is not a deity that made any decrees. It was Muhammad. You see, all the decrees came from the pen of Muhammad. Their demon deity did not decree their holidays. The Quran rarely mentions just their demon deity in decrees, but it says the demon deity and his apostle. So it is that demon deity granting Muhammad equal authority to Allah. Oh, by the way, do we not see that that is the stance of the Pope and the stance of the rabbis as well, that they are equal in authority to the God that they worship? And so it is that Muhammad has made the religious decrees, the decrees about Islamic religious life. These did not come from that one that they worship. Now, in the ancient world, not only did prophets make decrees, but ancient kings also made religious decrees. Kings have always used religious practices to keep people, you know, busy doing stuff so that they don't see what the authorities around them are doing. These have always been things that have been used to control the people. Somebody once told me that the greatest socializing force on earth is religion. And that's one of the paradigm shifts we also have to make, is to understand that we're not practicing practicing a religion. We are practicing the decrees of the creator of the universe. And we're practicing his kingdom here on earth. The Bible, though, provides us with evidence about kings making religious decrees in the book of Ezra, starting with chapter 6, verse 1, when it says, "Then Darius, the king, made a decree. And search was made in the house of the rolls where the treasures were laid up in Babylon, and there was found at Achmetha, in the palace that is in the province of the Medes, a roll, and therein was a record thus written. In the first year of Cyrus the king, the same Cyrus the king, made a decree concerning the house of God at Jerusalem. Let the house be builded, the place where they offered sacrifices, and let the foundations thereof be strongly laid. The height thereof 60 cubits, and the breadth thereof 60 cubits, and so forth and so on." So we see that it is that kings in the Bible can make decrees having to do with religious practice. And this particular king decreed that the Jews could go back and continue their worship of Jehovah. The point of all this has been to help you to understand what the difference is between Jehovah's ways and the world's ways. Jehovah declares his ways to us. The world just makes up stuff as it goes along, and then some king or some prophet or some, you know, priest of some, you know, other religion comes along and decrees that that's the way it's supposed to be. But not so with Jehovah. And I just hope that you're able to make that paradigm shift, because when you do, you won't ever want to disobey one of his feasts again. And then we have the distinction of mercy. And this shows up in various places in the Torah. The other place, of course, that we probably remember the most is about the mother bird and her egg. But here we see in Leviticus 22:27, "When a bull or a sheep or a goat is born, it shall be 7 days with its mother. And from the 8th day and thereafter, it is acceptable as an offering made by fire to Jehovah. But do not slaughter a cow or a sheep and its young on the same day." Now, in a related stroke of mercy is that you're not to boil a kid in its own mother's milk. And the reason for this is because these practices are pagan practices. And so the Lord is making a distinction between himself and other deities and between himself and other peoples by showing his mercy toward the animals in a way that the surrounding people, the people surrounding the Israelites, did not. Now, this is not to say that the Lord was not merciful before he made this commandment. Of course he was. But the people, as they lived over the millennia, twisted everything that the Lord did. And so he is telling us this is his mercy that was set forth at creation. This is not a new thing. That's always the argument that people make when they don't want to have anything to do with talking about the surrounding cultures. I've recently had this charge leveled at me that I was saying that the Lord had to make a distinction between himself and the surrounding people by just merely being different than them. No, it is that they twisted what he said from the beginning. Those people knew what he said. Those people who were drowned in the flood knew the commandments. They just were not following them. And over time, that happened again. But see, they have continued in their ways, and now the Lord has to explain how his ways are different than all those other ways. But his ways, his Torah, his commandments have been from the creation of the world. They are from before the foundation of everything that was created. Now, just in a few words, what is it that really defines all of the distinctions that Jehovah wants us to make in our lives? Well, we read it in Leviticus chapter 22, verse 31, where it says, "Therefore shall you keep my commandments and do them. I am the Lord." I hope this teaching has been a blessing. Shabbat Shalom.